They tell a lot of stories about Rockne. One of the stories I always enjoy is his team was losing at halftime, and he was a great fella to arouse the enthusiasm of his players at halftime and use all kinds of psychology. It was late enough in the season that all of his aunts and uncles and grandmothers and mothers had died or were dying, so he couldn't use them to stir his team on to victory. You'd have to have been on an athletic team to know how that is used. You know, win this one for my mother or for my dying uncle who was a graduate of this school and so forth. So he decided to take off on the name Notre Dame. And so he started out with each letter of the name between halftime. And you're playing for the Irish. And, of course, the green of Notre Dame. And when we think of the letter N, why, we say never give up. Never give up. The game is never lost. N. That's Notre Dame. O. If you're playing for the Irish, it's offense. 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 We never give up, and it's always offense. So he just was going right on through the each letter of the name of Notre Dame. Well, he got so carried away that before he got to the end of his letters, why, time was up. Referee came in and announced that 3 minutes, second half. And he still had his, you know, crescendo to hit, and that is E. And, of course, that would be enthusiasm. And he didn't really have a chance to do it full justice before he cracked a chair against the lockers and sent his team out there to fight for dear old Notre Dame. It may be my last game unless you guys win. And so they went trotting out through the tunnel onto the field, and as they were trotting out, some guy down on the third team someplace that would never see the game except from the sidelines said to a buddy, he said, after what he did with the letters of Notre Dame, he said, aren't we glad that we don't go to Massachusetts Institute of Technology? So Larry has informed you that you better stand up and stretch because you won't get to do it again for a full hour. So I'll take it from there that we're going to go through all the letters of Massachusetts Institute of Technology in our deal for today. I've got, oh, by the way, I brought a couple notebooks along, and these are not my notebooks, really. I take several magazines just to find out what's going on in business. I don't know anything about it, but I like to read up on it. And if we think in the NAVs that we're sharp or we work hard on some ideas, we really miss it. We're really novices playing in the woods. For instance, in this matter, what we call training men. The world is so far ahead of us. In research, in ideas, in concepts. And by the way, one of the reasons that business is changing from using the word training to the word coaching is that training has the concept of formal classroom, whereas coaching has the idea of man-to-man, or an executive dealing with his junior. Or, as in the words of one of the magazines itself, it's the idea of a man taking a small group, which they call herd. I don't know if he's just from the cattle idea or what, but a man and his herd. We use a band of men or a team of men. But this herd concept is very prevalent in business. One of the magazines that I enjoy, I don't understand too much about it, is Harvard Business Review. And most of the articles in Harvard Business Review are on the philosophy of business. And these are just excerpts of articles that I have taken out over the period of the last, since about 1958 when I started taking the magazine, of articles that have to do with training men, working with men, building men, helping those under you or working with those over you. Now, these are just excerpts from, and you can just imagine how many others articles there are that I didn't even clip out. These are some excerpts from the same magazine, Harvard Business Review. These are reprints. For instance, better use of executive development programs, the executive neurosis, which is, there's no one to take my place. and how can I help this guy under me become able to fill in? Human relations can be sharpened. Is management training effective? Measurements, objectives, and policy in management training. Reaction to university development programs. By the way, this is the big stuff 10 years ago, particularly after the Korean War. All big business was sending their executives and junior executives off to universities and Harvard Business School and so forth for training, figuring if they came back, they'd be all set. But this is an article just showing that there's a lot of problems with that. And the problem is that they're missing the on-the-job training, which is the key to training. It isn't how much you know, it's what you teach. It makes whether you're a good coach and so forth. Better use of executive development programs. Skills of an effective administrator. The engineer goes into management. Trends in management development. Manhunt for top executives. I mean, this is the stuff you see the business world is putting out. And you read any of these articles, reaching out for management. Train executives while they work. Well, this is what the business world is doing. Here's another magazine, and a notebook, and I have another one as big as this. This is Nation's Business, and these are reprints. Same thing, and I have these under topics. This has to do with executives. This whole section here has to do with leadership. Well, let me just read some of the... How to let go of authority. 8 skills in making a manager. Making leadership effective. How to pick your successor. Can you be a better leader? How to pick capable men. Training leaders for 1960. Where to find action getters. Yardsticks for future, and so forth. And then I have another section on management. One on making decisions, work habits, difficulties in working with people, creativity, and so forth. And then I have another one with about the same number. Well, I brought that along because I would like to challenge you, if you don't do it, to keep a file. Not for yourself, but to help others. Because constantly fellas come and you think, well, boy, I can challenge the socks off of him, you know. But if I could just give him something to read, and then we could talk about it and have interaction on what he's read. It's like giving out a track. I don't just hand out tracks indiscriminately. I usually like to give out a track, then where I can let him read it, and then I can get interaction back with him. I use it as a door opener. Well, that's how I use these. I didn't bring them because I didn't have enough arms. Like the octopus, you know, I had a girlfriend who went down the street arm and arm and arm and arm and arm and arm. Well, I don't have enough of those, so this is one of the books, How to Be a Successful Coach. Bonder is a line coach at Westchester State Teachers College in Pennsylvania. And he's one of the great line coaches of America in a small school. But when I read a book like this, and I reread it again, I thought, man alive, in the NAVs, here we are talking about, you know, how to be a successful leader. How to lead men, how to develop a team of men. How to get a job done. And this book is all on just, how to build team discipline, human relations, just the basis of personal attributes for a leader. And this is what the world does. So I just bring it along to remind us that if we think that we're cutting the mustard as Christians in this job of leadership, why, a long ways to go. Let me read to you something from a book entitled Planning the Future Strategy of Your Team. This is a business article. A man by the name of Mace, M-A-C-E. A chapter titled Developing Managers. It takes study, of course, to determine how much responsibility a man can actually assume at any one time and how it should be given him. I am sure that the boss who really studies this problem will not make the mistakes of what I call the Americandus Delegatus. The Americandus Delegatus is a new genius of bird that has appeared upon the scene. And some of my associates and I, through our study of actual businesses, have discovered this bird. Perhaps the Audubon Society will accept our collection as an official part of their bird organization. It should be called the business section of the Audubon Society. We would like for them to take in the Americandus Delegatus. The first delegation bird observed in American business is what is known as the white-shirted hoverer. He is the boss who gives his subordinate the job and then flaps his wings right over him all the time, hovering around and watching him all down the pathway, never giving him a chance to run into a stone wall and bump his head and thereby learn something. Are you a white-shirted hoverer? Very closely related to the white-shirted hoverer is the pinstripe hoopster. This bird's habitat is usually a so-called decentralized organization. Here is the boss who gives a subordinate a job, and then as the subordinate goes out to do the job, the boss hoops and hoops and hollers right down to the completion of the job. He hangs onto his tail feathers, by the way. Next, there is the yellow-bellied credit snatcher. Everybody knows this bird. I have a model in my office. I'd like to get rid of him. Then, of course, there is the pussy-footed mouse trapper, a rather common species in the business Audubon Society. And finally, one of my favorite birds is called the crested crown prince, the boss who by habit lays his eggs in somebody else's nest. How about that? Perhaps this little study of the Americanus delegatus will serve the boss as a reminder of the distinction between merely recognizing the concept of delegation and actually practicing it on the job with regard to his subordinates. Well, you see, this is just a little bit of how the business world is attempting to arrive at some of the problems that you and I are faced with in the Christian world. And by the way, I remind you that the great need in Christendom today are fellas and girls who are leadership potential for Jesus Christ, who want to see a job get done and have the vision of seeing it get done through others, not just building organizations. We're not just doing it all ourselves, but maybe a little bit like the crested crown prince, willing to lay some of your eggs in somebody else's nest and letting them get the credit. Well, let's get on with what we really want to talk about this morning, and that has to do with... Yesterday we talked about the philosophy of coaching a little bit. This morning we'd like to talk about the coach. We looked at a few verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 on some of the principles of teamwork and what it takes to be a leader. We talked a little bit about the difference between teaching and training and transmitting some of the concepts of coaching. This morning, I'd like for us to talk about the coach himself, or maybe just talk about you and me. I'd like for us to turn in our Bibles to kick it off once again to the fifth chapter of 1 Peter, where Peter talks to the leadership of his day. By the way, there are several concepts in the NAV work that are not navigator concepts, they're biblical, that we probably won't get a chance to hit too much. One has and the other one is pace setting and spiritual authority. If you've never done a Bible study on either one of these, it would be sure good, because there's so much in the Bible. We referred to a little yesterday about this ability to submerge yourself and Galatians 2:20 sort of thing in with others to get a job done. This is a matter of spiritual authority. That's what we're going to read about here. The matter of pace setting. We talk a lot about it. And of course, in coaching, this is a big thing. The coach has to be the living embodiment of his message. The Christian has to be what he would like for his men to be. Water rises no higher than its source. This is the tragedy so often in the ministry. You can talk about prayer, you can talk about personal evangelism, and yet, unless it comes from a heart that is a praying heart or a soul-winning heart, you know, it just, there's a hollowness, huh? In the eighth chapter of Romans, there's a principle that his spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are the sons of God. And I think that the same thing communicates in a meeting, that his spirit bears witness with the listener's spirit if the speaker's spirit is true. Moral honesty. Is what he's saying coming from a heart that is practicing in it, or is it just words? Now, a coach doesn't have to be able to run the 110 flat to be a pace setter. But it's pretty hard for a bunch of college or high school boys to knock off the beer if the coach is a guzzler. And it's the same thing, you know, monkey see, monkey do. Like father, like son. And if the coach is given to profanity, it's pretty hard for those kids, huh? And boy, the easy thing in the world is to challenge your guys or your gals to be hitting the book and to be turning out an STS every week. You've got to be immersed in that book. You've got to know the Bible. It isn't how many times you've been through the book, but how many times the book has been through you. See, we challenge our gang with this. But is this also, you know, what's good enough for the goose, is it also good enough for the gander, huh? And so Peter reminds some of his men in the Presbyterian church back there in the first century. Beginning with verse 2. Well, I would assume that would be true if it's going to be biblical. By the way, how many Southern Baptists do we have here? Let's see your hands. Unashamedly. Okay. How many just Baptists do we have? Let's see your hands. Yeah, I notice there is a distinction. How many Presbyterians do we have? Mm-hmm. Is the TMS Calvinistic enough for you all? Got some Methodists here, do we? Good, good. What else do we have? Christians. Yeah. I'm reading from Berkeley. I appeal to the elders among you. Shepherd God's flock that is with you. Not because you have to, but because with God you want to. And this is one of the first principles of being a successful coach, isn't it? The leader. The desire has to be there. The want to. The heart. I was privileged several years to go to coaches' clinics every year, and our school put the freight on the thing, so I was glad to go. One of the men I learned to love in his ability to work with men was a fellow by the name of Elliot, who was head coach at University of Illinois. Tremendous ability. The first week of August, he would move into the field house. Move to the field house. He would try to spend part of one day a week with his family, but the rest from August until the end of November, he lived with his job. He wanted to, and his evidently family was willing. Now, I don't think this is an exception. Sunday is no off day for a coach. As soon as the game is over, and he may spend some time with the alumni Saturday night, but all day Sunday, he's either looking at the films of the game they just played, or he spends at least a half a dozen hours with the scouts for the coming game the next week. And together with his assistants, they plan the strategy of what they will present to their team on Monday. And then Monday morning, he spends most of the morning with his backfield coach and his quarterbacks. So that before they meet the team on Monday afternoon, his assistants and his quarterbacks are agreed on what the strategy will be. And so he is willing, because he wants to. And of course, I'm sure in a lot of cases it's, the pressure of the Alumni Association and the school and the fans and the network and the pay and all the rest. And yet here Peter says, I want you to do it not because you have to, but because with God you want to. Not out of greed for gain, but eagerly. Not lording it over your charges, but becoming examples to your flock. There's a matter of pace setting. And with the appearing of the chief shepherd, you will be awarded the never-fading glory crown of glory. So too the younger men shall defer to the older, while you all put on the service apron of humility toward one another. And so forth, and a few following verses on humility. Several years ago, at the NCAA coaches clinic, they asked a committee to work out some basic tenets that would be common denominators for all coaches. Agreed upon principles that coaches should have if they're going to lead men, regardless of whether it be at the high school level or right on up through collegiate. I don't imagine this would particularly apply to pro ball, which is strictly a materialistic proposition, although a lot of them play it for fun. Willie Mays said the most embarrassing 5 years of his life were the first 5 years in the majors when he got paid for playing a fun game. He loved it so much that he was embarrassed to get paid for having such a good time. Well, here are five principles that the NCAA, this is National Collegiate Athletic Association, came up with, their committee. Tenet number one, ability to develop an organization. In other words, they felt that the time has come when we need to get rid of coaches who are simply personality boys, who can get in hoop and holler and slam the water bucket around and scream, and who maybe have been All-Americans themselves, but if he does not have the ability to develop an organization, he's not going to last long in the coaching profession. And boy, you can just think of the overtones in this. You see, I take the time on this because this is a leadership conference. And presumably, either by desire or somebody else's desire, there is the thought that this quality should be in your soul and the ability to organize and develop an organization. Tenet number two, he must have, of course, personal coaching ability. It's possible to organize and yet not be able to produce the goods. And they say that there are three things he's got to do. He's got to be able to sell, he's got to be able to plan, he's got to be able to teach. He's got to be able to recruit. He's got to be able to develop, and he's got to be able to send. I suppose that the day has dawned when it's going to be pretty difficult for a guy to not only be around the NAMs, but most any other organization that's off to the races before the second coming of Christ, who doesn't really have a heart of evangelism. If you don't really love to sell, if you don't have it yourself, this is pace setting here, isn't it? Personal coaching ability. Tenet number three, ability to plan work. Now this is bringing it down more from the organizational. That's more of the telescope. This is the microscope. The first one is the big picture. This has to do with community relations. And by the way, boy, how many of our guys need this? Just the ability to get along with pastors and businessmen and sister organizations in your area. And I would say that if you're having problems with InterVarsity or Campus Crusade, that it isn't their fault, it's probably ours. I'd say if we put on the service apron of humility toward each other, that we can get along with them. But most of us are so, you know, blinders on our, and all we're so zeroed in on our dealy-bob that We couldn't care less. And yet how a college coach needs to, boy, really build up the relationship with all the high school coaches, because that's where his material's coming from. And yet, what we're talking about here is the ability to plan work. This is now right in his own office. This is his own bailiwick. This is not just keeping the front lawn clean. This is keeping the closets clean, huh? Billy Graham at Dawson's funeral service right here said one of the things that attracted him to Dawson was that he was always interested in how a man keep his closet. He said, I always shuddered, he said, when he would open up my closet in a hotel when we were in a crusade. I was afraid he would. But Dawson sort of gauged a man by the way he kept the little things of his life, is what Leroy was hitting on yesterday, the small things, observing the details. They have the ability to plan work. And they put 5 points under this. Now, these are coaches. This isn't a business transaction. These are collegiate coaches talking. And they said there are 5 sub-points in the ability to plan work. One, he must have some goals that are established and all of his co-laborers know what they are. If you've taken any pedagogy, either in the elementary or secondary level, you know that one of the big things that they go after when you get into your practice teaching is the plan for the day, huh? Oh, man, wasn't that a bore? And yet, after you get into teaching, you see how right it is. And many, many a coach would be lost if he didn't have that clipboard and his plan and his goals for that week outlined. Otherwise, say, well, the old saying is that if you don't have any goal, you'll hit it every time. And this is true. I mean, if you aim at nothing, you won't hit anything. Point number two under the third point is break these goals down into component parts. Set some goals, break the goals down into parts. Three, set a time schedule. Four, hold your assistants responsible. Five, evaluate your practice plans. Practice, of course, in coaching is the big thing, preparation for the game. Evaluate your practice plans. The goals, the breakdown, the time, the responsibility, the evaluation. This comes under leadership of planning work. And this will apply to getting a group of guys doing a Bible study. This could apply to a group of guys organizing for a gospel team. I'm sure Leroy would hardly agree that one of the great things that creates enthusiasm and engenders interaction in the, with your band of men is to get a gospel team. You know, we think a gospel team is going to churches. Have you ever taken your men to a jail service? Have you ever taken them to the old people's home? Have you ever taken them out to the juvenile farm? This is where Dawson had a key in the smallness and the compactness of the early days of the NAVS, that he was always taking his men with him. And that's where we developed that with him principle. Of course, it came out of the Bible. But he was always, this is where the B-ration developed. Lauren and the guys went with Dawson to this juvenile detention home. These guys were saved and they couldn't see him during the week. And so they developed this little packet to leave with these guys in this home. And some of the great stories and some of the basic philosophy of the NAS was developed with Dawson and his band of men going around, spreading the good news, you see, with servicemen. With the Christian Endeavor kids, you name it. They got a chance to get their foot in the door, they were gone. Well, boy, how you could take, you see, this ability to plan. Well, it's the old story, and let me erase these three and then we'll put up the last two. It's the old story in business. If you can handle 10 cents, and you know the value of 10 cents,
then it really doesn't make any difference how many zeros you add behind that 10.
You'll still be right.
In other words, if you're wrong on a small thing, it'll be impossible for you to be right on a big job, huh? That's the reason why the cloud is so important. That's the reason why you step over that cigarette butt. Then when you get out in the Orient, you're over in Europe, you've got the responsibility of Argentina, you'll be stepping over spiritual cigarette butts. You see, you won't even see them. If you're afraid to keep short accounts with your roommate or the gal who's working in your home on a love basis in the spirit, what in the world are you going to do when you got a whole team of fellas and girls? You'll do the same thing, huh? The baby will grow up and you'll still be the same. And this is the reason for the emphasis. Tenet number 4, keeping abreast of technical knowledge. Keeping abreast of technical knowledge. Football has changed a lot. Basketball has changed a lot. Remember in 1936, I was in high school, I remember when they changed the rules. After every basket, there had to be a center jump. I remember when they changed it, how frustrating it was. As soon as the basket was made to take the ball out of bounds and started, boy, I really sped the game up. And that was a relief to be able to walk back to the center after a basket. So you had a lot of games, 21 to 18 or high scoring games, 35 to 30. And boy, in just one season. And I remember there was a lot of reaction, players and coaches. A lot of reaction when Naz trying to translate from a real small notebook to the size that most of you have there. And they still got stacks and stacks of small size, reaction, because in the new Bible studies that are coming out, the Bible reading sheets are that size and not the little teeny size, the little ones like this that we've been using for years and years. Oh, just a lot of things, just in the Christian realm that we resist change, don't we? We've been doing it this way for so many years. And just to suggest that maybe you share your quiet time with somebody else some morning to help them. Well, I never share my quiet time. That's something between me and the Lord. Or just to suggest that maybe we call the STS the PDD, whatever that means, or PDQ. We resist all these things. Why, I've had this Bible since Charlie Riggs put the ladder on it, and I'm not going to get rid of this Bible. King James, good enough for Paul, good enough for me today. This is the way we, huh? Can old dogs learn new tricks? Well, boy, you better. But we develop all these fetishes. The motto of the Navs is to know him and to make him known. Anything less than that is heresy. Well, how about something more than that? Boy, if somebody finds a fifth spoke on the wheel, why, he'd be anathema. He'd be defrocked. He'd be a Martin Luther. There are four inspired spokes, and that's it. God helping me, here I stand. I can do no less. Isn't that right? And after all, that's simply a tool. Now, there are basic principles that'll never change in football or any other sport. Blocking, tackling, running, passing. But boy, the development of that. I started coaching in 1942, and we ran out of what we call in football a short punt. And a short punt, this would be what we call a quarterback today, and it looks a little bit like a single wing. You got none of these diagrams mean anything to you, but this was the offense. This is the way we run our short punt. In 1944, George Halas, who was with the Navy down in the South Pacific,
had been working on what they called the T formation. A fellow who had been at Stanford by the name of Shaughnessy, who is still one of his great assistants of the Chicago Bears, put the quarterback right here. Now, up in the 1920s or so, you could not put the ball into forward motion until 2 minutes touched the ball. And then they changed that rule. And so that's where you got in, back in the 20s and the 30s, you had the power plays of the single wing and the double wing and the short punt. And this is when Minnesota was so powerful back there with their single wing and their power smashes. And then these fellas came up with what we call now the T. T because it's like this. And I remember the first game I coached. Oh, I had been to clinics and heard about it. I remember the first game I coached against the T formation. Oh, we got slaughtered. Oh, I felt so, because I was humiliated. I felt so sorry for my players. I talked to them about it, and I prepared them a little bit, and the team actually we were playing was no better than we were, except the offense was, and my boys weren't prepared. For instance, come on up here just a minute. I'm just going to demonstrate. I'm not going to demonstrate. I'm not going to stay there. I don't want to get your hand. But, for instance, in a play like this, I'm not going to do it. We had thought that when you team up on a block, why, you get right in here, keep your head up, and if there's a man on the other side, double team block, you hit him in here, or if it's single, you just hit him in here by yourself and move him out of that hole. Well, in this kind of a situation, the lineman would just brush block. In other words, by that, you just come into here, and if you just took him for 2 seconds, that's all you needed. In the other kind of block, you would just keep on digging until you heard the whistle blow, you know, and the thing was down. Well, the brush block, all you do is just come in and get him out, and mainly keep him from seeing where the ball is going. And then you leave him, and you go on downfield to get another man. And some of our linemen would be assigned for at least 2 and sometimes 3 basic blocks. And they were what we call touch-and-go blocks or blinder blocks. And my kids, you know, they were digging way down. I'd tell my guards, I want you to go down. I don't want to see you till the game's over. Never come up. Stay down in there. Well, the opponents, that's just exactly what they wanted. Because this whole offense, you see, was built upon speed and deceptiveness. And we didn't have to have a big hole like this. The speed just enough for a guy to get through when he was off. And then these linemen were all down here getting, and my backfield men, man alive, they never were so swarmed over. Simply because I refused to keep up with technical knowledge. And it took me at least 3 games. And of course, the coach for the next week had some of his assistants there and saw what happened to us. And I'm sure, oh boy, wait till we get those boys next week. Well, it wasn't long before my boys finally got up with it. And many, many teams back in the early 40s took tremendous trouncings. And many mediocre teams won because of not superior manpower. And by the way, in athletics today, the great difference is not so much in manpower, but in coaching. I don't think the Navs basically have superior manpower. I don't think they even have superior coaching in that sense. I think that there is just more of how to. And this is the reason so many pastors and churches and denominations want NAV help. Not because we've got spiritual giants walking around the NAVs. But they want somebody who will show us how. I was talking to a fellow, I showed him around the Glen here yesterday by the name of Carpenter from Memphis, Tennessee. He's got the big department furniture store right downtown in Memphis. Southern Presbyterian. So I was trying to explain to him the philosophy of the Navs. He says, you know, he said, this is what we Southern Presbyterians need. Somebody to tell us how. He said, many, many times I'd like to tell some of my business associates or the salesmen who come in a little bit about Christianity, but I don't know how. I wouldn't even know where to begin. Keeping up on and abreast what's going on. And then the fifth point that these men brought out, and that is team effort, developing it. And they say that there are 4 ways to develop team effort. First, you've got to develop habits. This is the way you do it, and you don't let exceptions occur. This is the reason you practice and you run your plays over and over again. This is the reason in basketball every guy takes 50, as a minimum, free throws every day. And if they can't hit at least two-thirds, they keep on shooting until they can. Just doing it over and over, practice, practice, practice. We talked about this just yesterday, a little bit in the philosophy of William Hoppe. Doing it until it becomes automatic. Now, be careful in the spiritual realm, you see, because you don't want to just become automatic, do you? This is where the Holy Spirit comes in and makes the difference, huh? I mean, it's automatic in the spirit. But don't let it become perfunctory. Your Bible study or your prayer life or your witnessing, there's got to be that insurge and that infilling to keep it alive. The second thing is the matter of enthusiasm. This is the old pepper-upper, you know. I think there's a real need for this in Christendom. We of the Reformed faith probably have greater problems of this than anybody else because, you know, we're a little on the Calvinistic side. We figure God's going to do it anyway, you know, and doesn't need our enthusiasm. And Oral Roberts maybe be a little bit on the other extreme of the pendulum. This is the jet fuel that they got a hold of in Acts 2 or got a hold of them in Acts 2 and tanked them up, and wow, did they go into orbit, huh? And this is the thing called desire. I've got some young gals up at the ranch who are from Christian College. Well, it doesn't make any difference which one it is. It's Bethel College in St. Paul. Boy, they're sharp gals. But none of them have ever done Bible study. Now, most all of them are from good evangelical Christian homes, and most of them are Scandinavian background, so real conservative. They go to Christian school where they get a lot of Bible and sit in chapel, and, you know, they've been to church camps. They've never done Bible study. Well, we're doing STS. We're in the book of Ephesians. Well, you know the book of Ephesians. Tremendous book. And you can mechanically do it, you know. These girls are just, you know, they're drowning now. They're looking up to try to find daylight. And basically, as I've talked with them, it's the desire. They've always been fed. Somebody's always been there with a milk bottle, and all they've had to do is go, you know, and... No, kidding. Some, you know, every day, 5 days a week, there's some guy coming to Bethel College, he's got a great big spoon, and he fills it with tabum, and then he goes... You know? And if they don't like it, the house mother at night burps them, you know, and they got all their... Why should they study the Bible? Hey, they haven't been out in the battle. They haven't any way to wear off the excess fat. So they're taking in... Now they're up there. Well, these pagans, these wonderful, unsaved people, you know, who they don't know Jesus Christ except as a profanity word or some historical Jewish character. And it's a little hard on them. And they're beginning to evaluate. In fact, one of the girls, I got a problem with her because she decides she doesn't want to go back to Bethel. She wants to go to the University of Minnesota. But the battle is. I may have some parents coming down my neck here. Well, you know this is true, huh? Just the desire, I put down four things. This enthusiasm, you have to create a desire to learn, a desire to improve, a desire to excel, and a desire to win. And I don't believe anything less than that fourth one is good enough for a Christian. If you don't have a desire to see the Great Commission accomplished in our day, well, why don't you just get off the bench and turn in your uniform and do something else, huh? Boy, this is on the heart of God. This is the heart of the quarterback. This is the rule book. The whole thing is here, and, you know, we just want to be cozy. We want to be around with a bunch of Christians, and, You know, we want to get fattened up for the harvest and for the slaughter, whatever it's going to be, and no desire. All we want to learn, and we want to improve. We want to keep up with the norm. This is the problem with us. We're living on that plateau. We're above everybody else. I mean, the mediocrity of most everybody else in the Young People Society. When you go home, you're a spiritual giant, aren't you? You can reel off verses. You can get up and pray extemporaneously. You can do more than say Jesus saves and keeps and satisfies. You can do more than quote John 3:16 or John 1:12 or... You're a giant. And that's not good enough. Because you know you're not a giant. You're just walking on stilts. And you got your pant legs rolled down, they can't see what you're walking on, you know? And the termites are going to get in there one of these days. Isn't this right, Leroy? Isn't this what we need? Men who want to excel and men who want to win? Yeah. I don't know how you spell it in Greek, but there's a great word, excelsior. Excelsior. It isn't just stuff you put in packing. It's the desire to excel. The spirit. To be the best. To get to know this book. Have you ever gotten on your knees and said, God, help me. By the Holy Spirit, I want to know your book. And if it's going to mean some isolation, it's going to mean some obscurity, if it's going to mean a period of time, just, Lord, I want to get to know you. Lord, I want to be a soul winner. I want to be that man that can do something for God. Who's Scotty? Just a little old boy from Omaha whose father worked for the railroad. Dad was crushed in a railroad accident. Skinny little fellow. Great heart for God. He hasn't got a university or college education. He went to school and Dawson called he and Doug Sparks out of college to go overseas. I mean, who's Bordy? He came back from World War II, a has-been. Over the hill. Well, I sure hope we can find this veteran a job. And you just think down through the annals of men, and boy, there are some great ones. There are Apostle Pauls roaming around today. But by and large, they're just... You take Bill Bright. The first time I knew Bill, he was running a chain of candy stores in Los Angeles. And I forgot why I went over there. Mrs. Kerr had negotiated to buy a whole bunch of... Every year she used to buy turkeys for all the Nav family. This is Ruth Kerr, Kerr Glass Company, a very dear friend of the Navs. And then she also bought wholesale a whole bunch of box candy. And she said, just go over and introduce yourself to Bill Bright. He's the owner, and you can pick him up. And we're to distribute him to all the Nav families in Los Angeles and Long Beach. And this is the first time I met Bill. And I was quite impressed by Bill's operation. He said, I'm selling it all out. I said, you are? I said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to go to Fuller Seminary. I said, seminary? Yep. He said, I got to know something about the Bible. And what was this gal's name at the Hollywood Presbyterian Church? Henrietta Mears had gotten a hold of him. And she says, she thinks that before I start doing something, I better learn something besides business. Oh, well, you know, he'll go there a couple years and get in debt and get discouraged and have a few more babies. And he'll be back in business. He'll be sending candy again. Boy, he's selling candy, isn't he? Boy, he's bit off a bite out there called Arrowhead Candy Bar number one. We're a bunch of pikers, and we bought this thing for $340,000, you see. I hear an advocate say, oh, he's a fool. Boy, buy a $1 million thing like that. Why didn't you spend that money for reaching the world? That's exactly what people told us, gang. I sat in the Missouri Athletic Club in St. Louis with Dawson. Businessman said, I wouldn't put a nickel in that place. He said, when people around the world are going to a crisis eternity and you're going to sink $500,000 into a piece of property, and I have seen it, and it's nothing but a white elephant. Get on with the job. Well, old Bill left the candy store because he wanted to see something done for the college kids. And there are some Bill Brights sitting right here, huh? And there are Bill Brights sitting out on your campus. They're sitting right underneath your nose. And they're not Phi Beta Kappas. And they're not going to be Miss America. And they're not going to be the great personality. Man judges by the outward appearance, but God sees the heart. A little freshman came up to me at the end of the season in 42, and he says, "Coach, any chance of me getting in?" Weighed less than 120 pounds. His name was Danny. Well, we happened to be winning the game. I said, "Well, Dan," I said, "when there's 1 minute left, you let me know. This is halfway in the last quarter, and I'll see." I thought, oh boy, his folks were up in the stands. His older brother was the star of the team. Well, I'd like to get him in. And he just so anxious to play, and a little hard, 120 pounds of just pure fight. But, you know, 120 pounds even in high school is not very big. 170, 180, 190 pounds, you know, and he was small, boned. He's just afraid, he hadn't developed yet. It's funny, I put him in. I said, "Now, I want you to play safety." And I said, "They're throwing passes," but I said, "Don't worry about it, you just stay out of the way." His brother was playing linebacker, so I said, "Now, you make sure that your brother Danny stays at least 40 yards behind the line of scrimmage." Do you know what happened? A guy caught a pass over the center of the line about 15 yards behind his brother and hit it right down the right down toward the goal line, and the only guy between him and the touchdown was this little guy put in. I just stood there like this. It couldn't have happened, and it did the very first play. The guy didn't even bother to move out. He didn't try to go for the side. He just moved right ahead, and he went right over the kid and exactly knocked him out cold. As soon as I saw the guy running, he was 5 yards from the kid when I started running out in the field. And boy, knocked the kid out cold. Well, I was just thankful nothing but the wind got knocked out of him. But this little kid had this very thing. Enthusiasm, the desire not only to learn and to improve, but to win. He went on and became all-conference. Went on to college, became little all-American. But that which I saw when he pulled, you know, on me there in 1942 is still true of him today. He's up here in Denver, Danny Gardner. Goes to Bear Creek Presbyterian Church, an elder there. He's one of the outstanding businessmen in Denver today. And that same drive, he only weighs 150, 60. But boy, down inside is that same desire, you know, and desire for other kids, desire for Jesus Christ. He's making money like mad, you know. Let me just finish it so we can go on to something else tomorrow. Responsibility. Is the third quality of leadership, and the fourth quality is discipline. And we know very little bit about discipline, do we? Now you notice the first letter of each one of these words spells something that we've been talking about. This is what these coaches of NCAA say make up for a team effort. And these are the five qualities that these coaches said a couple years ago are basic tenets to making for top leadership in the coaching profession. May God take them and translate them into concepts that will help us be leaders for Jesus Christ, huh? Tomorrow we're going to talk about the players and the coach's relationship to the players. Shall we bow in prayer?